Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. Well, this is it's coming along very nicely, the Buddhist project. We Hajahn Sudhanto and I believe Tan Chaganando will be accompanying him, are good friends of ours. They were, in fact, the whole group have recent. Well, let me just go backwards here. He is currently dwelling at the Pacific Hermitage, which he is the founder of. He is from the Abhayagiri community in California. So it's the Portland Friends of the Dhamma. And you would recognize if you went there. It's like this, and like you. And so these are my people. We have tribes all the way down the coast. And so we have three. In fact, Ajahn Tanisaro's is in San Diego, so he's running almost from Mexico right up into British Columbia, basically the length of the Pacific Crest Trail. Our four monasteries, which we call the Axis of Goodness. And, so as opposed to the Axis of Evil. And so eventually we hope to get it so you can bicycle all the way down from one monastery to the next monastery, visiting monks and meditating and so forth. It would be ideal, in an ideal world. So yes, we're very happy that, and also Victoria is, of course, a beautiful, lovely spot. It's just that there's just not enough monks in the world. And so we're spread rather thinly, but we are doing well. It's not something you can force the growth of, and so it just takes time. But it, compared to my early days, it's a cornucopia of monasteries and monks. If you remember the first Theravada monastery in the Western Hemisphere, since the time of the Buddha, was established in Washington, D.C., in an old embassy house in 1966. So, only 2,400 years to get here. There's no haste. Since 1966, there's been quite an incredible development. And the monasteries, if you count all of the different, that's the Theravada tradition. There were earlier arrivals, of course, in Vancouver. The earliest temple was actually a Japanese temple in Steveston, 1905. And then there were some Chinese immigrants as well. But the Theravada came late to North America and South America. And now they're in the hundreds, really, the Theravada groups. I think just the Thai Wats, they call monasteries Wats, or Vihara, and the Sri Lankans, the Viharas, are dotted all through North America, and we even have some in Mexico, and so it's quite a growing thing. So when Sudhanto and Chaganando come through, you must pass on my greetings from them. I only saw them a few weeks ago, and I actually went down, and also at their invitation, a few weeks ago, I took my second monk, Tan Subaru, and we went down by train to White Salmon. I'm sure you've all heard of White Salmon, a village of about 2,000 people, and they established the Pacific Hermitage. It's about a 20-minute walk outside of the town, so they're trying to do it in a very traditional way, where they have no lay people that live in the monastery. I'm not sure you know that monks do not handle money, they don't cook for themselves, they don't drive cars and things like this. So in order to make it viable in North America, we have lay people who actually make sure that this happens somehow. And in our monastery, we call them stewards. And they're attempting to go stewardless without any intermediary, and to rely on alms rounds and just walk through the streets of white salmon with a bowl. And it's quite the experiment. So I went down, we went alms round, white salmon, and it's actually working. They don't have a steward, and they get fed. How it works, for a while, nobody knew what that was, and they were all kind of mystified by these. So they, eventually people got the nerve to come up and talk to them and so forth, and then they got invitations to, there's a lovely yoga center, it's a beautiful place, the White Salmon is, on the Columbia Gorge, and a lot of windsurfers move there because it's so good for that activity. And so they got an invitation from the local yoga teacher to come and teach, like every week, and just have a sitting and so forth right there. It's a nice, it's twice the size of this room, I suppose, at least two or three times. And then people, you know, they came up to them in the street, too. What are you anyway? So, and then we, you know, this explained. And I said, well, you know, I'd like to offer some food, and then so, and they arrange it like so. They have three alms round routes in the town, and they, if a person is going, and they have various people who have said, yeah, I'm up for it, and they have various signals, so they leave a little flag on the post office box or whatever it is, if they're going to offer food that day. So then you just walk up to the door and come in. And two or three people provide enough for the couple monks, you know. So, and then you know, it works just like in Asia, actually. It was quite delightful. The first house we went to, we were invited in, and then the lady said, you know, oh, you got some more monks here. Yeah, four. These two are Canadian. She said, oh, I was born in Canada, too. Yeah, where? Oh, you went to Westminster. Then, so yeah, where were you born? I was in the Royal Columbian Hospital in Westminster, and so was I. What day? You know, so it turned out we were, you know, crib mates. So that was the first alms round house, you know. Born in the same hospital, and like within a month of each other, you know. We went to the same high school, too, so it was, so she was a, yeah, she, her religion is windsurfing, but we, at the same time, she's obviously open to the Dhamma, so she's, it's quite wonderful, the karmic tangles and interesting stuff that happens. So anyways, when Sudanto and Chaganando come through, you give them the message from me. Tell them Ajahn Sona loves them. Okay. I've known Sudanto for 18 years or so. At least 18 years. So I will talk tonight a little bit on the... just about the, came to mind on the way over, where Brock and I were talking, and he said about, what is it that the Kuan Yin statue is holding? There's a kind of a little vessel, something. And I said, well, I'm not too sure, although I could make up a story, but, and in fact, all, you know, it, all of these things, there is no absolute meaning to things. It's what, it's all Dhamma that you can project on these things. But it is a kind of a vessel of, you know, some sort of medicine or healing or love or compassion or something. And I was telling him a story about a retreat that I co-conducted with another monk in Canada, Ajahn Virodhamal. And I hope one day Victoria is blessed by a visit from Ajahn V. He's the senior monk in Canada. Lovely character, and they have a monastery outside of Ottawa near Perth, and it's called Tisarana. So this was probably 15 years ago. We were conducting a 10-day retreat outside of Toronto, and a woman who was a fairly long-time practitioner then, and she's a psychoanalyst or psychotherapist, came into one of the retreat, into the interview, and she said, "Well, I'd like to. I kind of had a vision. I've never had a real vision before, but I was sitting in meditation, and I really had a very vivid. It was almost beyond a vision. It was seemed so real. Anyway, I was taken up, and I flew across the ocean." And then I came down in the mountains, like Tibet or someplace, and I was right in front of Kuan Yin. Not a statue of Kuan Yin, Kuan Yin. And Kuan Yin was just radiantly beautiful, loving, compassionate. So Kuan Yin is the bodhisattva of compassion. You have probably seen, looks almost like Mother Mary, you know, and she's elegantly, delicately, there's a very serene, beautiful face, and she might be holding this little container of something. And and then Kuan Yin asked me, she said, Janice said, Kuan Yin asked me, what do you want? And she said, I want to heal. And so Kuan Yin said, this is for your healing. Which eye will I pour it in? Which eye will I pour it in? Your left eye or your right eye? And so she said, pour it in my left eye. And then Kuan Yin reached out, and then suddenly Janice said, no, my right eye. So Kuan Yin poured it into her right eye. And then the vision ended. So then she said, what do you think that meant? So from me, from my point of view, as I was listening, it was very clear what it meant, that it's these visions are often something like dreams. They're in the dream language, where words are almost in a childish way, they're taken it to mean something else. So when Kuan Yin asked her, which eye will, should I pour it in, my left eye, your left eye, or your right eye? That eye is not this eye. Just, it's the eye, you know, eye. Which eye will I heal? I mean, why are you here? Why did you come across the ocean to visit the Bodhisattva of compassion? And so she was asking, she decided, my left eye. And that the eye that's left, that is left meaning deserted, has been left, been something missing. Maybe a childhood thing, you know? loss of somebody, something. And so there's lots of people have these experiences and you feel something is missing. Somebody has left. Something has left me. And so that was the option of pour it, this compassion into my left eye, my that which has been deserted. And then as, of course, that's the first impulse. And then as Huanyin is preparing to do this, then she suddenly thinks, no, into my right eye. So what is my right eye? My right eye is right view. You know, you even see, it's nice multiple, you're right, the right view. That is, when you're looking for healing from a specific traumatic event, from a specific sense of loss or something like this, the kind of healing, and remember this woman is a psychotherapist, the kind of healing that we seek is through analysis and through trying to relive the experiences or sort these things out in the sense of treating the self as very, the I as kind of real. And that it's a real event that happened to a real person, etc. And that kind of compassion is possible. It's good, it's healing, but it's limited. It's about a very specific approach to life and healing, and that is healing the self. But this having practiced Dhamma, now this occurred in a meditation retreat. And then she's at the last moment switching to this. No, pour it in my right eye. So the right eye is a different view of the nature of the self and why it's wounded, deserted, whatever the pain, the suffering is differently conceived in Dhamma. It's the other side of it's another way of looking at things. And the compassion that Kuan Yin is administering is Dhamma. It is the compassion of truth rather than what we consider to be sympathy. It's what cures you, what frees you from suffering is not being held or sympathy. It is to be able to see things in a new way altogether, right? And that is the difference in the approach to the whole issue of suffering. So when we're, you know, practicing Dhamma and bringing that into our life, we have to always be asking. Well, we're going to encounter people in our lives that are very sympathetic to us, that we find healing and so forth, and we're going to encounter books and things that seem to address our situation now and our sense of self. And that is, we should remember that is our left eye. And, you know, compassion and healing and so forth poured into our left eyes is nice, it's good, but it isn't where the Buddha is pouring his compassion. So the Four Noble Truths, the essence of understanding why we suffer and how we can transcend this suffering is another place for compassion to be poured into. It might even be another hemisphere of the brain, you know, it's a different side of the brain. It's the part that is cool and spacious and free and light, right? It's not the part of the brain that takes everybody seriously, including ourselves. So part of our thinking process, this has got to be very deep. It's got to be an evolutionary function to conceive of the self as an entity which persists through time as a solid object, to see others as nouns, as solid things that persist. That's got to be some sort of functional process that makes life and sorting out things simpler, probably. Makes it easy, makes it simpler. You say, pass the apple. It can take over, and perhaps the structure of our society is dominantly refers to everything as objects and nouns, as things. And it's so easy to forget that they're not, that an apple isn't a thing, that apple that you're going to get past, that's just one phase of what an apple is, right? Isn't an apple, can it be smaller? Can it be a seed? Can it be a flower? Can it be a tree? When is it really an apple? Is it at any stage of this process, this flow, why do we call it that? Why do we think, when I say apple, why do we think of that thing, you know, size of your hand? That's because we like to simplify reality and make things into nouns. But there is no nouns. There are no nouns. I suddenly had a flash of my grade 2 teacher. There are no nouns. Apple. One apple plus another apple, two apples, noun, verb, is, are. So, you see that process is still flowing, patterns flowing. So, the flow of life is actually its real nature, and perhaps one side of the mind understands this. It's not a noun, it's a verb. It's just continuous flow. And until we listen to that side, until we have insight delivered from that side, until we have the truth poured into. So practicing meditation is exactly that. It's pouring and pouring and pouring. Using your imagination and your memory, in other words, how do you conceive of, when you hear the Four Noble Truths, when you hear that there is suffering, there's grief, sorrow, lamentation, loss, getting what you don't want, losing what you want. And then when you hear that the cause of this suffering, the roots of this suffering is attachment or misunderstanding about the nature of reality, avijja, and that this can come to an end, this relationship to reality as imminent sorrow, and that there's possible to undo this structure in a systematic way through the Eightfold Path, etc. So this is, when you hear this, you have to process this through imagination and memory, don't you? It's not something that you... There are types of meditations where you don't have to use imagination and memory, such as breath meditation, so where you just dwell on a single object that's apparent to you without any intermediate of conceiving or thought or visualization or memory, imagination. But to understand, we actually have to process this. And this other dimension of our, this other eye, in now not as the eye of self, but the eye of vision. So this is another metaphor. There's a lot of eyes tonight, eyes. I'm going to dot all the eyes here. So this eye we call the eye of wisdom, panya. This is an eye that is the eye of the mind, of course. You know, you hear about third eye and sort of third eye stuff, but of course there's no eye as in E-Y-E. This is the way the mind sees things. This is the capacity for sight. We might even say vipassana or insight, which the mind can perform. It has this capacity to see reality in a different way, but it needs a lot of rinsing and washing, processing again and again. It needs to be, the similes they often make is that the Buddha talks about making the mind wieldy and malleable. And that is like taking clay, you know, before, in order to make pots and so forth, you take clay and it's stiff and so forth. You have to work things, moisture into it to make it workable. And this is the nature of the making the mind workable as well. This is, so you're pouring it through. So this process of making the mind workable is the development at the higher end of the path. You have to understand, well, what are the kind of efforts that I have to make the mind see, to allow this eye of wisdom to see. I have to make the right efforts. And that's one of the great misunderstandings, but it has to be understood. What is this? It's around emotional things. It's the process of right effort applied to the emotions. When we see the nature of the emotions which are fundamentally delusional about reality, that they are misrepresent things to us, that they focus on things that are not necessarily true. They exaggerate. And that is the primarily dominant ones are aversion, that is pushing, not wanting, and then desire, wanting. These are the two dominant ones. The rest are secondary to those. Those are the two dominant ones. And they are fueled by this mind that is conditioned to see things in a blinkered way. It sees things as nouns. It sees things as stable. It sees things as possible to possess. It sees things as having faults which are, should not be there, that you feel you object to. So this is the product. This is how aversion rises. Desire arises by perceiving objects as something that you could get, that you could keep, that you could control, that you could have. So the misperceptions based on the lack of processing on this other side, this other way of seeing. So we perceive things as controllable, as ownable. And that's the primary problem. So the Buddha, when he talks about the self, and this is one of the mysteries of Buddhist language, you talk about anatta, the absence of self. And that tends to puzzle everybody. But not so puzzling when you read how the Buddha thought about anatta. He thought about it as command and control. The primary problem with the self is not a scientific problem, not even a philosophical problem. It's the instinct to control and the feeling that we can command the world around us or the world within us even. That's where you suffer. It's not a brilliant idea. It's just about how you suffer and why, and it's your relationship, the feeling of ownership. The owner is the self. And there is no self, so there is no owner. And so we're always blundering around and being shocked because the things that we have sometimes are taken away from us. And there we have a direct contradiction to our perception of reality, that we had something and now it's gone. If something could if you can lose something, then by that's the definition of ownership, is to have. If you can lose it, I guess you never had it. If you could really own something, you couldn't lose it. But since you can lose things, things can vanish on you, can disappear, then you, that sense of ownership is illusory. Remember, we're talking about ownership, not rentership. We don't feel like, you don't suffer when you think everything is rented, like your husband, your wife, your kids are rented. You rent your kids. It's very strange. That's true. They are rented. But we think we own them. And so it's only once we have the wrong perspective on things that is not possible in this world to own anything. That is the Kuan Yin pouring medicine into your right eye. Suddenly unburdened by this delusion of ownership. You don't have anything. You feel light, free. Things drift by. You're in a canoe in a river. You're paddling, and of course things drift by. All kinds of little presents in the drifting in the waters, and some with your name on them. Gifts, people, hi, you know. You meet people along in this river, this flowing river. Very beautiful, but don't grab on. If you ever done much canoeing, especially in flowing water, sometimes if you get a little panicky, you might want to grab a branch hanging over a river above you. A bad idea. You have to treat this experience appropriately as a fluid experience, as a river of events. And you are, at first you even perceive, this is the first way to think about it, is you are canoeing, sort of gently bobbing and playing with the currents that move you through life. And there are many currents, all kinds of little whirlpools and so forth. Little places, you know, when you look in a stream, behind the rocks, sometimes there's a, even in a flowing stream, you can put your canoe behind the rock and you can sit there without even paddling, and you can rest there for a little while. There are moments where you will get rest, so forth. But the inevitable, irresistible flow, which is time, is always moving. And so we feel like, so that's one thing. Now the next level of it is to realize that the canoe itself is fluid. The canoe is like your body. Your mind, your body is not, when we say everything's impermanent, we hear that all the time in the Buddhist teaching. Everything's flowing and impermanent. We look around, that's true. Everything out there is flowing and impermanent. Everything's insubstantial, right? Yeah. And then everything's suffering. Now, that always puzzles me. It's suffering? I mean, like the wall is suffering? The stones are suffering? I can see that they're flowing and substantial. But that they are suffering? No, I'm suffering. So that's actually this flowing, changing, insubstantial is not out there. It's in here. This is the thing that we think is permanent. It's not that. We have this strange intuition that the same person who looked out at the world yesterday and said, it's all changing, is the same one that looked out today. Said it's all changing. That sun's coming in my right eye.
Would you like us to move the asana?
You could close the left blind. That's good. No, if I just move like this. Both eyes can be open without being blinded by the light. So the flow. This is one thing that I spent quite a few years, appreciating the beauty of the Buddha's teaching about how everything was impermanent out there. And then one day I thought, what about me? You know, I started to reflect on this idea that if everything is changing about me, everything is flowing and changing. I could, so you're looking, you're trying to, when you say insight, vipassana, you're turning your eye inward, you see, looking in at the flow. So it's very interesting because the thing, you know, the thing that's looking in is also changing. So the incredible thing that the mind can do, it can split itself into two. It can observe itself. It's very strange, amazing. The mind can be both its observer and observe the contents of the mind. So who's looking at the contents of your mind? It is. The mind is doing that. And it's kind of playing ping pong with itself. It's so fast it can hit the ball and then get to the other side of the table. And get this feeling, this illusion that you are looking at you. So it's very fast. But in fact, that is in fact a rapid, it's probably a single thing that's going back and forth. So, but the thing that looks, that's the thing, is that which looks is also flowing and changing. So there's a flowing, changing thing that observes. And what does it observe? It observes flow and change. So this is how we get to dissolve the sense of self, is that we realize that there isn't a solid... That's the illusion, is the sense of me, the same person that was thinking about things yesterday, is the same one, the same little marble, something or other. Now, this is the problem, as we always say. When somebody says, like, who are you? I mean, when where's your real self? And this kind of thing, it always mystifies us and stops us in our tracks. In fact, that's... In the Tibetan tradition, they say, you know, that's the only real puzzle, is this question, single question, who are you? And because we intuitively feel that there is a real me, they said, well, okay, we'll give you that question, you go off and find it then. If there is a real you, you go off and find it. So this is where it wants you to directly find yourself. If you have one, find it. If you feel that all that talk about anatta and no self is very interesting, but I just still feel like me. So if you feel that there is a you, then find it. And that's the authentic search. It's only when you can see the evidence yourself that you cannot find yourself, that the results happen. Now, what happens when the self is questioned, the very sense of self is questioned? Not taking the problems of the self as real, not taking the wounds of the self as real, as the problem, but taking the whole, the very sense of a self as real. Self as that which persists unchanged through time. That's what the self is. That which persists unchanged through time. When we look for that, we cannot find it. Now, what does that do? It just undoes a wrong theory about reality, is what it does. And it can be it's a revolutionary experience. So it is like discovering that you're not on a flat earth, but you're on a spherical earth. Very strange. I talked to a woman who grew up in Cambodia, in a village, and she ended up, she never went to school. Her mother kept her at home doing this and that, and just kind of a farming village, and so she never actually went to school, but she was quite an attractive woman, and when she got to be 22 or something like that, some Australian spotted her and married her. So she moved off to Australia, where one day she was at home in Melbourne or something. Now, I'm talking to her some years later in the monastery, and she said, I was watching a TV thing, and I had enough English to, and I suddenly realized what they were saying on this television program is that the earth was spherical, that it was around. She had grown up in this generation with the belief that the earth was flat. Because this is so interesting. Intuitively, that's the way it does seem. And they didn't have discussions about the spherical nature of the earth because she didn't go to school. That's where they talk about it. Her mother never said, you know, the earth is round, dear. You know, so your mother doesn't talk about things like that. The rice is not finished, you know. You've got to cook some more rice. So she said, I was in a panic. I couldn't believe it. I checked it with my husband when he came home. I said, do you know what they said on this? Now, this is a strange program, but they seemed to be real. They said it was round. And her husband, you know, was like, yes, dear. What did you think, you know? And she said, it took me months and months to get this sense that, how could it be round? I mean, wouldn't the water all fall off? It's like, so this is an intuition which is natural to us. No wonder it looks flat, you know. So this is contrary evidence. And so this is the nature of the examination of the self, too. This is quite contrary to the way we naturally, intuitively feel about things. It's quite contrary. And it's curious, and against the way we ordinarily talk as well. But it really is true. Really is true. There is no... The you that woke up today is not the one that went to sleep last night. And the one that woke up today is not the one that's listening now. And the one that was listening then is not the one that's listening now. And so, see, the one that was listening then was listening like this. And then the one that was listening then was this. It was going, ha ha. So it couldn't be the same one because it's experiencing it differently. So that's very liberating. We, as an idea, we're not too sure why it's so liberating. But as a... So it's got to be... You know, if it's an idea and a curious idea and an interesting idea, it's not what the Buddha's talking about. He's saying it's an emotional transformation. He's saying that the worries and fears of the self, the imagined self, vanish with the self. So it's the worries and the fear about this imaginary is why we have to see through our misconceptions about the way things are. Just like the sailors that were on these oceanic voyages and who believed that the world was flat and that you could sail off the edge. You can imagine the worry about that, the worry about those that it kind of went off in a waterfall off the edge, and it would be that's something that'd give you nightmares. Especially if you thought, you know, you're not too sure whether you're getting close to the edge, you know. But you can imagine the transforming experience if they really had it explained and shown to them that it wasn't flat, it was a sphere. What would happen is, of course, the whole anxiety and fear about falling off the edge, that's what would vanish. That's what the important part of the information is. As a scientific fact, it's interesting. But as an emotional fact, it's positively liberating. So that is the kind of processing that we have to do to feel, to unburden ourselves from, to, as the self, the idea of the self becomes lighter and we're less convinced about it, one of the famous things starts to get lighter as well, and that is death. Because who's going to die? It's when you're deeply convinced of a solid, commanding, controlling self that the stronger and more vivid the idea of self is, the stronger and more vivid the idea of death is. And the more problematic the whole thing is. And so as we can at least, and remember, this doesn't necessarily all happen in once. The Buddha talks about a gradual passage, so kind of the sense of self becomes less vivid, less clear-cut. It starts to fade. It's not as intense. And at the same moment, all the suffering, the death, aging, loss, anxiety, the fear of the future, the regrets over the past, also in the same fade. So this is why it's so critical. It's a liberation of the emotions, concept that the self changes, then everything the self owns, wants, fears, hopes for, and ultimately its own annihilation becomes as irrelevant as as falling off the edge of the earth does. So those kind of processes, that's what you'd be looking for. We can make it fade a little bit by just things like loving kindness. So the sense of self, as the emotion of friendliness and goodwill rises, we feel more connected to other beings, identified with other beings. So the sense of the individual self, the small self, tends to fade out, and there's a kind of a liberation. One of the things, side effects of that, it's not complete insight, but one of the side effects of that, very famously, is a reduction of the fear of death. So the Buddha talks about the benefits of loving kindness, if practiced and developed and cultivated and repeated many, many times. One of the benefits is one becomes clear and lucid, and the fear of death decreases. Isn't it interesting that emotion, which is the emotion of the recognition of others as like yourself, also reduces the whole burden of self? And reduces the burden of the self's imminent ending as well. So that kind of freedom is profoundly to be wished for, aspired to. It's truly a happiness unsuspected in ordinary life. And why the Buddha's thoughts are not mere philosophy reserved for elite philosophers, but are to be brought for everybody into the midst of their ordinary life, because that's where we live. In that sense, the worries, the fears, the regrets, the puzzlement, the incapacity to accept certain things, that's where we live. And that's where the Buddha is pointing, into the ordinary life, not into high philosophy, but into the ordinary life. And can we do anything about that? Can we release that where we live? So that you can pursue this by reflection. But I must say that if we try to just rotate the ideas, we often have not made the mind ready for it. So the practice of breath meditation and loving kindness is just softening up and making the mind ready to allow these insights to flash up in a way that doesn't present itself as either just boring or intellectual or frightening. The mind, the heart has to be settled, so you're feeling very secure and stable, and then you can reflect on these these issues around the self, and what it means to be alive, and what it means to be mortal, and what it means to lose things, then you can reflect in the proper spirit of that, and that it will be profitable, emotionally transformative. So that's why the value of this, of practicing serenity meditation as a preliminary to understanding and insight. And the value, of course, of having ideas like this, both imagination and memory, to comprehend what it is that one is supposed to understand. So the two work together. Samatha and vipassana, serenity and insight, work together like this and are really inseparable to allow this realization to come up. So I will leave you with those reflections for